2012, January 24th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 14, Cells, the Building Blocks of Life. We're continuing on this basic theme of what is the nature of life on Earth. And so we're taking this detour into biology, but I'm going to be very selectively looking at biology for those bits that give us the basics of biology that help inform our real purpose of the inquiry in this class, which is understanding life on other worlds. And we want to understand life on Earth, we have to understand the most fundamental building block of life, the cell. So today's lecture is going to talk about the basic properties of cells as the units, basic unit of all life on Earth. Most life on this planet is single cell. So in fact, talking about cells is really talking about most of the forms of life on Earth. We're going to talk about the basic components of the cells, which are carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, left-handed amino acids, and nucleic acids. We're going to come back to various of these themes. This particular lecture, in many ways, sets up some of the subsequent lectures. We're going to introduce the two different types of cells we find on the Earth, the prokaryotes, which are single-celled organisms that lack a cell nucleus, and the eukaryotes, which are single or multicellular organisms that have cell nuclei and other structures. It's going to turn out that prokaryotes are going to be the bacteria and a class of bacteria-like creatures called archaea, whereas eukaryotes are going to be, well, us. We're eukaryotes in some sense. All of our cells are eukaryotic. We're going to then use the differences among the different types of cells for single cellular organisms up to animals is going to define something called the phylogenetic tree of life. This is a very, it's called that because it has this branching structure which looks at genetic differences among different organisms on the Earth. And because it forms a sort of tree and branch structure, it's called the tree of life, which is a nice poetic name, but actually there's a much deeper meaning behind it. It's a way of organizing life by the biochemical and genetic relationships among them. It's a new way of organizing life that's really only arisen since I took biology in high school. And we're going to see that life breaks down into three basic forms: bacteria, archaea, which we'll define here, and eukarya, basically single-celled prokaryotes, ancient single-celled prokaryotes, and eukarya, which is multicelled eukaryotes and us up there. So this sets the stage for describing life on Earth and ultimately the evolution of life on Earth and its history that will be the subject of next week's classes. But the basic unit that we're going to be working with today, we're going to be looking at through here and the rest of the time, is we're going to be looking at the cell. The cell is the fundamental unit of organization. Remember that all life is structured, and the cell is that fundamental structure. Well, cells form a number of basic functions. One of the most basic is they provide a boundary between inside the cell and outside the cell. They provide a bag, or what the biologists like to call a membrane, that separates the cell functions on the inside from the environment on the outside. Now, of course, the environment on the outside in a multicellular creature is the other cells right next to it. But fundamentally, whether it's a single cell or part of a larger organism, there's a boundary between them called the membrane. It keeps the inside and the chemical functions inside and keeps the environment outside. Now, the cell membrane is actually permeable. It's not a brick wall. It allows nutrients to pass inside, and perhaps more complex cells might actually use chemical signals from outside, such as nutrients or chemicals that they use to interact with their environment. And you can send junk out of the membrane into the environment, waste products. So, for example, a cell that might use sunlight, that might pull in water and carbon dioxide and use sunlight to make sugars and oxygen. Oxygen is waste for those cells, and so there has to be a way for the oxygen that it makes inside to get out. Similarly, you have to wait for the carbon dioxide in the water that it uses for that chemistry to get in. So the cell membrane is extremely important to the structure of the cell. So what is the cell keeping inside? Well, it turns out if we look at creature to creature, organism to organism across the Earth, what we find is a surprising amount of similarity both in structure and function, despite the fact there is an immense diversity of differences of form. You might think a human being and a bacterium could be about as far remote from each other as possible, but in fact there are deep interrelationships that we can find, even common pieces of our genetic code. There are pieces of the genetic code of human beings that are written inside of bacteria. What are these pieces? What are these things that we can find common ground with? The first thing is that every single cell on Earth that we know of uses DNA as the method for encoding hereditary information. We'll say a lot more about that in a couple days when we talk about DNA and heredity. But every single cell, now we're not talking about viruses and prions. We're talking about bacteria, archaea, and eukaryotes, all use DNA to encode their hereditary information. All cells use RNA, ribonucleic acid, in order to be the biochemical machinery, if you will, that makes proteins and enzymes. Proteins and enzymes are the functional chemical units of cells. In fact, all cells have broadly similar chemical functions. The way they use proteins, enzymes, particular chemicals, for example, as we'll see in a moment for energy generation, they all share exactly the same or very, very similar to the same biochemical functions. It's how they mix and express those functions that makes the difference among the different organisms, how they're organized in detail. What's interesting is if you start breaking down all forms of life on Earth, you find that not only are there similarities, but they use only a limited subset, a very particular mix of chemical compounds. In particular, they only use a small subset of the possible number of amino acids that exist on the Earth. And we'll define these in just a second. This amount of commonality is very important because it's pointing very strongly that there is a common ancestor of all life on Earth. That every form of life that we see today and in the past arose from a single common ancestor that had this biochemical machinery within it. We don't see life on Earth with completely different biochemical machinery, with completely different DNA and RNA, completely different energy generation, completely different amino acid use. It's all common from the smallest, simplest looking bacterium you can find all the way up to us. That's a very important clue as to what nature of life on Earth. It also, I'll say just in passing, might give us a way to recognize truly alien life. Truly alien life would be different not just simply in appearance, but in its detailed biochemistry. So what is this chemistry? Well, the basis of life on Earth is carbon chemistry. We often hear the term, which interestingly comes primarily from science fiction, that we're carbon-based life forms, as if there's some other basis. On Earth, all life is carbon-based. You may have heard some articles in the news about a year or so ago about an arsenic-based life. Bullcrap. That wasn't arsenic-based, it was just arsenic-tolerant. That was just NASA getting a punchy headline. It was still carbon-based. It was a bacterium that was just unusually tolerant to large amounts of arsenic. We'll probably say something about that a little bit later in a different lecture. Now, if you break down the chemical contents. So imagine this was the contents of a human being tattooed somewhere on your butts, basically a list of your nutrient content or your elemental content. It would look something like this. We're 65% oxygen, 18.5% carbon. You may remember that number from a recent homework. 9.5% hydrogen, and then some mixture of nitrogen, calcium, phosphorus, potassium, sulfur, sodium, chlorine, magnesium, and then trace elements of all kinds of other stuff. It's interesting that we say we're carbon-based, and yet oxygen is far and away the most abundant element in the human body. That's because most of the oxygen in the human body is tied up in water. Now, this is fraction by mass, not by number of atoms. Okay. So most of our mass is oxygen, but that's because most of the oxygen is tied up in water. So the actual functional bits, the things that actually make us living, water is the substrate, the medium that the chemistry occurs in, but it's carbon. The molecules that are responsible for cell structure, that are responsible for cell function, are all carbon-based molecules. They owe their chemical structure to the properties of carbon. So what is it about carbon that makes it so special? Why is carbon a basis for life? And the reason is because carbon actually has some really unique chemical properties that make it really special, that make it really versatile. You can form just a huge number of different carbon compounds. Carbon nucleus is pretty simple. It has 6 protons and 6 neutrons surrounded by 6 electrons. The 2 innermost electrons form a closed shell. That doesn't do much for us chemically at all, but the outer shell contains 4 electrons. To close the second electron shell, you need 4 more electrons, but you're not going to get them because carbon only has 6. The fact that there are 4 bindable electrons, which we call valence electrons, available for chemical bonds with others, including other carbon atoms, is what gives carbon its amazing chemical bonding properties. With this combination of 1, 2, 3, or 4 electrons, I can form single bonds, single electron exchanges, double bonds, 2 electron exchanges, or even triple bonds. Triple bonds are super strong, single bonds are weaker, double bonds are in the middle. So already I have 3 different ways to bond with other things by exchanging electrons. My colleagues in chemistry would hate to hear me say this, but basically chemistry is all about the exchange of electrons, mediated by whether or not you need to take energy or give up energy in the process. That's all of chemistry. The rest is detail. So true with basic chemistry for life. It's going to be all about doing stuff with electrons. So we've got to really pay attention to the electrons here. But carbon is amazing in what it can do with electrons. It yields the richest chemistry of any element. Hydrogen, oxygen, dirt simple chemistry. There is really only a handful of things oxygen and hydrogen do. But you put carbon in the mix, it can do an amazing number of things. You can take a carbon and surround it with 4 hydrogens, that makes methane. We're going to hear a lot about methane in this class. It's a very common molecule throughout the universe. But I can break one of those hydrogen off and bring another methane and bounce it together, and I can make 2 carbons with hydrogen, or 3 carbons. I can form gigantic chains. In the deep spaces, deep dark areas of interstellar space, we find the radio and millimeter wave signatures of carbon chains. I think the current record is 13 carbons long, just in interstellar space alone. Carbon's marvelous at forming these long chains. These chains are called polymers. Now, but we usually think of chains as single directions. I can also branch in various ways. And now all of a sudden the long chain takes on an asymmetric structure. It can be left-handed or right-handed structures. So I can have mirror images and not mirror images. Handedness suddenly comes into play. So I've suddenly broadened the number of possible geometric structures by making these branching. Furthermore, carbon does something pretty amazing. It can take these branches and fold them into rings. Sometimes they're 6, sometimes 5. Sometimes it can put a nitrogen in the corner, sometimes not. I can form whole chicken wire combinations of carbon molecules. Carbon's amazing in this way. The sheer diversity of the types of bonds, the types of compounds it can make, we don't actually have a counting of the number of possible carbon compounds that can be made. We can make things that are huge. There are some carbon molecules, single carbon molecules, that have 75 carbon atoms in them. And they're just getting started. And they're compounds called buckyballs. And that's pretty big, and that isn't as big as it gets. We're going to meet some molecules. Deoxyribonucleic acid is a very complex three-dimensional molecule that can have literally millions of atoms in it. So carbon compounds are special. And there's another wonderful property about it. Almost all these compounds readily dissolve in liquids, especially water. If you can dissolve an atom into the liquid phase, you have a carrier. Liquids are wonderful as a carrier or a substrate, a medium for those chemicals to be in, because it allows ways to transport those chemicals around from place to place. It allows ways to transport nutrients into carbon compounds and produce waste products or byproducts out of that. So having this medium is extremely important. There are literally millions of possible combinations here in carbon. No other element that we know of does this. Either the bonds are too weak. For example, silicon has a very similar structure, as we'll see later. But the bonds are weak, so it never forms really strong chains. We're going to see silicon as a possible basis of life way when we start talking about really crazy alien stuff towards the end of class. But carbon is king. What are the carbon compounds we care about? First of all, these compounds often have a name because they were often synthesized first from living organisms. Before people really understood chemistry, they were called organic compounds because they came from life. They came from living things, plants, animal material. So people split chemistry artificially into organic and inorganic chemistry. And we still keep that split. Organic chemistry refers to carbon chemistry. So whenever you hear me talk about organic versus inorganic, organic means carbon, inorganic means things that are not carbon. So organic chemistry, these organic molecules, can be quite complex. And there's certain groups of these that appear over and over again in living systems. Carbohydrates, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. These are very important within cells. They are the principal means to store and transport energy, nutrients for cells. In particular, sugars are a form of carbohydrate, carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. They also can form structural compounds. Cellulose is a carbohydrate. It forms some of the pieces. For example, the structure of a tree is made up largely of cellulose fibers. So the tree is basically a great big hunk of carbohydrate. The other form of carbon compound I can make are very, very long chains, mostly carbon and hydrogen, with a couple oxygens tossed in or maybe some other stuff. These long chain molecules are called lipids, sometimes referred to by their other name, fats. Lipids can store and transport energy. It's hard to think of it, but in fact, fats are a form of energy. They turn out to be the main components of cell membranes, of the bags that hold the functional elements of the cell together. They also play a role in signaling between cells. They're chemical carriers that can actually control, maybe the word control is not right, but mediate cell function. If one cell changes state, it can chemically, if you will, communicate that change of state to others by the emission of a bunch of lipids which carry a kind of a chemical message to it, a chemical with a certain shape that bonds to the cell and says, hey, your environment just changed chemically. Here's a microgram of a cell showing the cell membrane, and you can see how it's got kind of this double wall structure. If you look carefully at the double wall, it's basically a bilayer sheet consisting of lipids. You've got kind of the oxygen, the fat part, and the long strands here coming together to form this bag. We're going to see this again when we start talking about the origins of life, what the first forms of life may have looked at like on Earth. The formation of these kind of lipid bubbles turns out to be one of the possible ways that you've got an organizing principle, right? To something that makes the difference between inside and outside. If I took this bilayer sheet, we got the outsides of the lipids and the little dangly bits of the lipids joining together like that. What if I turned them around and put the heavy bits in and the outer parts going like that? You've all experienced that one. That's what a soap bubble looks like. Soap is fats. Basically, it's lipids in a suspension. So the ability of lipids to form bubbles this way, they can also form bubbles this way. The difference is whether the water attractive sides are on the inside or the outside. In a soap bubble, it's water on the inside. In a bag that's sitting and immersed in water, the water-bearing bits are on the inside and outside, like this, forming this bilayer sheet. I know I'm throwing a lot of stuff at you, but it's just the stuff is really cool. Right? Very, very simple compounds make up some very, very complex structures when put together. However, the big compound, the one that really, really important to cell function, are proteins. Proteins are also carbon compounds, basically. They're composed primarily of long chains of units, chemically identifiable units called amino acids. The amino is telling you a little bit that nitrogen is playing a role in this one now. So remember the principal elements for life are carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen. So far we've seen carbohydrates and lipids, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. Now we get to nitrogen. Nitrogen plays a role because nitrogen is the principal anchor of the amino acids. Amino acids chained together in various combinations make proteins. Proteins are the fundamental chemical unit of cell function. Everything that's done in your cell is done by way of proteins or related proteins called enzymes. Now, some of the proteins also provide structural roles within a cell. Certain combinations of proteins can add stiffness, for example, to cell walls and make them a little bit more or less permeable or give them structure, make them stand up a little bit, if you will. Enzymes are a subset. Enzymes, while they have a different name, are proteins, and they're given a different name to distinguish their function. What enzymes are is they're proteins that act as chemical catalysts inside of cells. What's a catalyst? A catalyst is basically a chemical that is not consumed by a chemical reaction. Here's an example. The enzyme here forms this kind of substrate. This is the active enzyme here, it's a substrate. It connects onto the substrate. The enzyme changes its shape slightly, changes the nature of the chemical that's bonded onto it, and then the products pop off, but the enzyme stays where it is. I might have thousands upon thousands of chemical reactions going on that are taking in certain chemicals and spitting out products, but only one enzyme just keeps getting recycled over and over and over again. They are, in effect, chemical factories. They're reused over and over again. You often hear about catalysts in everyday life. For example, someone being a catalyst for activity, something that causes something else to happen. Or some of you may know that your car has something called a catalytic converter. It's basically a thing for breaking down hydrocarbons made from exhaust, but it does so without actually consuming the catalyst, the chemical inside that does the breakdown. So catalysts are very important because they allow repeated chemical reactions without consumption of all of the elements. If I was, say, taking hydrogen gas and oxygen and making it into water, that chemical reaction consumes all of the products. A catalytic reaction would make hydrogen or make water without consuming one of the pieces. There's a non-consumable in the chain. So these are going to be very important to cell function because they're going to form, if you will, the centers of the chemical factories that work within the cell that provide cell function. The most important unit of the protein. Proteins are chains of amino acids. And amino acids are one of the key compounds here. Amino acids are really the building blocks of life. They're carbon compounds. They consist of two groups. Their basic structure is just repeated, but you have many, many different combinations. What gives them their name amino is an amide. An amide is nitrogen and two hydrogens. So that's where the nitrogen now comes in as a key element of life. They're bonded through carbon in the middle, and then they carry a carbon-oxygen group called a carboxyl. Okay, CO2 would be carbon with two double-bonded oxygens on either side, but I break one of those oxygen-carbon bonds and tack a hydrogen on the end, and I get a carboxyl. So whenever you see an amino acid, there's an amino group on one side and a carboxyl group on the other, and then in between I put a carbon and a hydrogen, and I vary the radical. I change the structure of this dude right here, and I get different amino acids. We know of presently more than 70 possible types of amino acids on Earth. Different combinations of basically popping a radical down here on top of this amine and carboxyl group. But of those 70, only 22 of them appear in living systems. The other 50-odd do not appear anywhere in living systems. Every now and then they might show up in, you know, the cell wall of a bacterium, but they're not as strongly, maybe not as functional in the same way. Furthermore, of those 22, 20 are primary, two of them are found only in extremely rare, and we think extremely ancient microorganisms. But wait, there's more. Not only are they only used 22, but we only use, of those 22, 19 have a handedness. Actually, sorry, 21 of them have a handedness. They could be left-hand or right-hand symmetry. Life only uses the left-handed versions. We've only found one example, one, of a right-handed amino acid anywhere in nature on Earth, and it's some amino acid in the cell wall of a particular bacterium of completely unknown function. We don't know why it's there, it just is. Maybe it has something to do with the stiffness of the cell wall, but no one's sure. But left-handed amino acids are all over the place. But you look out in nature where amino acids are made by various kinds of processes, you find more or less equal mix of left and right-handed versions, but only left-handed versions operate inside living cells. That's telling us something important. Okay. I want to show you this just so you can bask in the glow of these are it. These are the 22 amino acids of life. They're all pretty simple. They all have an amine group, an NH2 bopping around in there somewhere. And, you know, they've got various names. But notice the L in front of these. That's levo or left-handed. The other forms would be D or dextro, which is Latin for right-handed. They're all the left-handed forms. You see an awful lot of oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, carbon. The carbon is unlabeled there at the joints there. But sometimes you get rings, sometimes you get open structures. Only glycine here doesn't have an L or D in front of it because glycine has no handedness. It's the only symmetric, non-chiral, as we'll learn in a second, amino acid. And some of them are kind of funky. For example, cysteine, levocysteine here, has sulfur sitting on there. And where is it down here? Ah, yeah. Selenocysteine is the same as cysteine, but instead of a sulfur in that position, it's got a selenium. What's that all about? We'll leave that for another day. Keep that in the back of your mind, though. Sulfur and selenium, what are those doing there? All right, let's move on. Handedness. Handedness turns out to be important. In living creatures, naturally occurring amino acids, the ones that occur outside of living systems, come in a mix of right-handed and left-handed systems. We even find amino acids among the organic compounds making up meteorites. There are certain meteorites that carry a lot of carbon organics from the outer solar system. We find a mixture of right and left-handed amino acids within them. For example, the Murchison meteor. We'll talk a bit more about that later in the class, but I'll just throw that out there. But when we look inside of cells, we only find the left-handed versions. Amino acids in non-living systems, and amino acids show up in non-living systems as well, are just always a mix. But biological living systems only use the left-handed versions with, like I said, one or two exceptions which we don't fully understand. Now, this handedness is referred to as chirality. It comes from the Greek word for kairos, is a hand. So just like a handedness, I can't overlay the right and left hand. I have to undergo a rotation or transformation to do that. But it's the sidedness that matters. So a reaction that uses a left-handed amino acid, if I filled it full of a right-handed amino acid, that chemical reaction would not occur. I can't build proteins out of right-handed amino acids. So this handedness is very important. But there are right-handed amino acids. I can, in fact, form chains of right-handed amino acids. They just don't do anything. Or maybe they do, but not in the systems we understand. This is another piece of evidence that people point to of the idea that there's a common ancestor, that whatever our original form of life on Earth, that all their forms evolved out of, only used left-handed amino acid chemistry and only used a small subset of those amino acids. And that information, the instructions for building proteins from amino acids, is carried on through heredity. Heredity is carried by DNA. That's part of telling you what part of the function of DNA is. DNA carries instructions for how to build a cell's function. You build the cell's function by building proteins out of chains of amino acids. So amino acids are part of the building blocks of the cell, but then the instructions come from the nucleic acids. So the nucleic acids are the basis of storage and transmission of heredity inside of cells. All cells on Earth, no exceptions, use nucleic acids in order to transmit heredity information and also to determine and mediate cell function as follows. The most famous of the nucleic acids is DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. The DNA is the fundamental unit of heredity inside of cells. It contains, coded along its length, and we'll talk about this more on Thursday, the instructions for making proteins and making a one-chain version of a nucleic acid called RNA, ribonucleic acid. RNA used to kind of take back seat. People knew that DNA was the big star. It got all the press. It was the one that showed up on the red carpet at the Nobel Prizes. But RNA turns out to really be the important one because DNA is just the messenger. It's just the transmitter and the replicator. So it's very important. That's not just. But when it makes RNA, what does RNA do? It does all the work in a cell. RNA determines a cell's function. It is the primary piece that manufactures proteins and enzymes that in turn determine the cell function. So the RNA that's built by the template carried in the DNA carries the information needed to chain amino acids together to build proteins. Some of those proteins, when they're released from the RNA factory, fold up and form functional proteins, maybe part of the cell wall structure, maybe something else in the cell. Others of those proteins fold up in a way that form them into enzymes. And now you've suddenly built one of the fundamental units of the chemistry of the cell. Different DNA carries different RNA instructions. You build different enzymes inside of different types of cells. And that gives you the different chemical factories. The way I like to think of it, sort of as a two-step way of thinking, is DNA stores the operating instructions for the cell. It's the book. And it carries the means, the mechanism for reproduction of those instructions, passing those instructions on from parent to offspring, heredity. But RNA carries out the instructions encoded in the DNA and determines the cell function. A cell cannot function without both. DNA would simply be a book that copied itself. RNA makes the cell functional. It does something. In fact, without RNA, actually, the DNA couldn't reproduce, so they got to come together. So these are the fundamental chemical building blocks of cells. We get the carbohydrates and the lipids that are fundamental for carrying energy and for producing cell structure, and a little bit of messaging on the side. The amino acids are the fundamental building blocks of the proteins. Proteins and their big, specially folded versions, the enzymes, are the engines of chemical activity. They're the functional units of cells. And finally, the nucleic acids. DNA carries the instructions. RNA carries them out and basically determines cell function. The RNA stops working. The cell basically stops functioning. The cell dies. All right. So let's look at the types of cells. There are two fundamental types of cells we find on Earth. Only two. They have a lot of diversity among them, but there are very common features. The first of these are called prokaryotes. Okay? Acaria comes from the Greek word for nucleus or kernel. And so these are things before having a nucleus. These are single-celled organisms that do not have a cell nucleus. This kind of, in fact, there's no subdivision within these cells at all. There's a membrane, which is basically a bag of stuff. Yeah, there's kind of a lump of DNA. There's maybe a couple of ribosomes, which are special types of folded up RNA. There's a bunch of proteins and enzymes running around, maybe a few lipid bodies, and some other funky, interesting stuff like a flagellum to move them along, and various interesting little structures that can pop out made of various kinds of proteins and lipids and carbohydrates. But there's no walls inside the cell. There's no divisions. There's no little organisms, or organelles as they're called, that are separated by little walls of things. So they're very, very simple. They're just a bag of chemistry. Well, a bag of some very interesting and wonderful biochemistry, but they're bags of chemistry. Turns out these are the simplest and most common forms of life on Earth. If you want to sketch what the most common form of life on Earth, and I suspect probably the most common form of life on the universe when it arises, it's going to look something like this. This sort of sketch of a generic bacterium over here on the right. On Earth, we recognize actually two very distinctive types. Used to be up 20 years ago, before about 1990, we would only have said bacteria. But lately, there's been recognition that there's a second group of what used to be called bacteria called archaea, for ancient. These have significant differences in their internal structure, and especially significant differences in the membrane structure that makes them very, very different from bacteria. So we divide them into two very distinctive groups. Now, they always still say single-celled. There are some prokaryotes, some bacteria, that will go through a life stage where they will just temporarily be multicelled, but then that quickly breaks apart. There never are multicellular prokaryotes as a single functional unit. However, they can form big colonies, lumps of goo that happen to be, you know, this, things that look sort of... They live in caves and they drip down from the top, and they're basically the gigantic bacterial colonies. They're called snotties because, well, that's kind of what it looks like. But that's an example of these colonies. We're going to see, for example, in early life on Earth, and there's still some forms of this, large algae mats or large bacterial mats on the Earth. They're basically just huge aggregations of these things, but they don't act like single organisms. They don't have moving parts or differentiated parts. They're just big lumps of goo. These are important because the very first forms of life on Earth are the prokaryotes. Yeah, question right there.
Why do they form the colonies? Do they have different functions within each colony?
They do not. There's no differentiation of function among the colonies. It's just a big pile of them. They replicate, and they don't move far from where they replicate, and you sort of just build up like a whole bunch of them. It's just literally a big pile of sort of, you know, microbiological goo. Gulp. So these are the first forms of life we find on Earth are prokaryotes. In fact, most of the life on Earth now is in the form of prokaryotes. And most of the life for most of Earth's history was prokaryotes. Eukaryotes, as we're going to see, the more complex cells that we're made of, are latecomers in the history of the Earth. We'll say more about that next week when we're talking about the detailed history of life. Which brings me to the other form of cell that are common, the eukaryotes. These are single-celled or multi-celled organisms that have cell nuclei. The genetic information is actually in a walled-off little section of the middle of the cell called the nucleus. It's very distinctive. In addition, there can be other subunits that are also encapsulated in various ways. The first thing about eukaryotes that distinguishes them from prokaryotes is they're big. They're much bigger than eukaryotes for the most, prokaryotes for the most part. Second is the cell nuclei are encapsulated. Within the cell, there are substructures that form, have very distinctive boundaries, right? Remember that the purpose of a cell membrane is to form a boundary between inside and outside. Eukaryotes take that one step further. And within the cell itself, there are functional units that have a boundary between inside the functional unit and outside. In a prokaryote, it kind of all floats around in the same single bag. There are other subsets, in addition to the nucleus, something called an organelle, little organs, that are specialized units of function in the cell. For those of you who know something about biology, mitochondria, one of the power units, if you will, of a eukaryotic cell, are also walled off little units. And I'll give away a little bit of stuff. Basically, a mitochondrion actually even carries a little bit of its own DNA. It's, in fact, a prokaryote living inside of a eukaryote. This is giving us a hint as to where eukaryotes came from in the course of evolution of life on Earth. Multicelled organisms are composed of groups of these cells where now there is, as going from the woman's question up here just before, now you have kind of a lump of cellular material, but their functions differentiate. My skin cells do something different than the muscle cells beneath them, than something but the bone cells beneath them. They're all built from the same DNA, right? Sperm and egg only contained so many chromosomes and so much DNA, contain the instructions for building a human being. But I have liver cells, skin cells, brain cells. There are 100 trillion cells in the human body, all of them differentiated into different functions. In a simple multicellular organism, there might be an inner group of things and an outer group, which might be motility pieces. Or in a human being, vastly complex function. But there's a differentiation of function. That's the difference between a cell mat and a multicellular creature. A cell mat, back the prokaryote over here and the prokaryote over here, they're just doing the same thing and they really don't know what the others are doing. In a multicellular creature, not only is there differentiation of function, but there is communication between them through chemistry in some way. Maybe one is making a chemical that's used somewhere else in the organism. And these together work together so that the whole is greater than the sum of the individual components. Plants and animals are eukaryotes. We are eukaryotes. We are made up of cells with nuclei, membranes, and organelles differentiated into different functions. The other differentiation is the size. Now, it's a plot you don't have in your notes, but it's one I plucked off of Wikipedia, since they're back from their little protest. Eukaryotes are big. They range from about 10 microns. Some of them can actually get almost up to a millimeter. A really big, nasty-looking amoeba can get up to about a millimeter. Prokaryotes is a little bit of overlap at the bottom and top end. The prokaryotes are basically fill in this middle zone down below a micron. Below that are viruses, fit in a niche down there. Then proteins, and then you get down to the scale of small molecules and atoms. Proteins are, remember, they're just big chain molecules. So we've got quite a bit of separation here. Basically, viruses sit in the size range and in a range of complexity between big chain molecules, proteins, DNA, stuff like that, and prokaryotes, actual functional units, cells. Viruses themselves, again, we said they were kind of on the boundary between living and non-living. No one would call a protein or a big molecule itself living. No one doubts that prokaryotes and eukaryotes are living things. They can reproduce, they utilize energy, they have structure, they evolve. So how do we organize life? How do we look at, we have prokaryotes, prokaryotes can be divided up into bacteria and archaea. We have eukaryotes, which can be anything from a single-celled amoeba or smaller units to very complex multiple colonies of different eukaryotes, which are like animals, plants, human beings. Used to be there was a taxonomy, a way of classifying animals by their appearances. You'd say, oh, they're this color, they got this kind of hooked of a claw, or this kind of beak. And you know, Linnaeus and other people through the 17th and 19th centuries classified all life together, and they saw relationships. You know, all dogs look like wolves, all cats look like lions, and birds all look similarly, so they could find lineages in there. But they didn't know about the process of heredity, and they didn't know how to read genetic information. When we started learning how to read genetic information in the 60s and 70s, we realized that sometimes creatures we thought were related were also genetically related. Duh. They have similar functions. But we also found there were some deep interrelationships that were often unexpected. And so people began to change from an appearance and function-based taxonomy of organizing life to genetically organizing life, to putting things together by their biochemical and genetic relationships. For example, systems that share a lot of similar genetic information in their DNA, or that have particular functional units that are shared among them but do not appear in other cells, tell you that they came from a common ancestor that started with that same function, and then evolution, natural selection, split them off for various reasons. And what you find is a tree. And the way this tree is found is the relationships, the branches here, are by relationship of genetic information. So a creature running along this Aquifex group, as you get closer and closer to the node of the branch, they become more similar to the creatures out on this branch. As I move out along the branch, creatures along this direction diverge in their biochemical function and their genetic function. Furthermore, the bacteria differ from the archaea, but way down here. These halophiles, a particular type of archaea, are way different from, say, proteobacteria over here. There's an awful lot of genetic change between this point and that point, but you follow the lineages back, and eventually you come back to here. Somewhere along the line, archaea, bacteria, and eukarya split off. We're way up here in the corner, out on the end of that branch. And there's an awful lot more branches we're not showing. We kind of stop at basic things like animals, fungi, plants, various kinds of microscopic things. Almost everything on this diagram is microscopic except for slime molds, animals, funguses, and plants. Everything else is single-celled or maybe at most a couple cell units. So these are all single-celled bacteria. These are the archaea. These are the eukarya. This organization of life is looking at the genetic relationships. What we find is there's a tremendous amount of similarity. Okay, first of all, this changes that the bacteria here and the archaea used to be bacteria and archaea were together, but there was a recognition, as I mentioned before, about 20 years ago, that there were some real differences. The archaea also turn out to have some interesting properties, as we're going to develop over the next couple lectures. They tend to be oddballs. They tend to live in very extreme environments, extremes of heat, extremes of cold, extremes of salinity, extremes of acidity. They interact primarily with methane rather than carbon dioxide as their source of carbon and things like that. They have very different internal biochemistry in many ways, but there are common elements to their biochemistry that we find in the bacteria, which are, you know, things we're used to, gram-positive bacteria, E. coli, and some other funky stuff running around. But they all use DNA. They all use the same mix of left-handed amino acids. It's just their differences go way, way back to this as yet unknown root. Eukaryotes have similar function. They have a lot of similarities with bacteria. They also use the same 22 amino acids or 20-odd amino acids. They use DNA and RNA. They use proteins. They use certain ways of making energy, as we're going to see when we talk about cell chemistry tomorrow. The branches, as I said before, represent the amount of genetic difference between these. The further you are on many branches, the larger the number of genetic differences. But eventually you follow those lineages back, you find a lot of genetic similarity. And so as we follow backwards, we eventually reach a point where the genetic similarity of even the three major lineages of eukaryotes, archaea, and bacteria begin to merge. This is taken as evidence of an as yet unidentified common ancestor of all of these, the initial form of life, or could have been one of many forms of life, but this one was successful, that had utilization of left-handed amino acids, DNA, RNA, adenosine triphosphate as energy mechanism, and so forth. So life on Earth has amazing diversity. There's a tremendous diversity of life forms, from bacteria to very complex animals. But if you dig below those surface differences, there are similarly tremendous similarities and commonality among them. We all use the same 22 only left-handed amino acids. We all use DNA to encode and store heredity. We all use RNA to carry out those instructions within a cell. We all employ broadly the same cellular chemistry for the machinery of proteins, enzymes, and various ways of making and transporting energy. If we study in detail the genetic makeup, we find those deep interrelationships go all the way down through the genetic tree. This is a very, very powerful piece of evidence that points to a single universal common ancestor to all forms of life. If a second common ancestor arose, we would see a completely different chain of biochemistry. In an alien world, it might even be more different. And so it's one of the things we're going to use to try to distinguish terrestrial from not terrestrial in the future. Any questions? Okay. See you all tomorrow then.